Hi, Left, Right, and Center listeners. This is Sarah Fay, producer of the show. This week's episode was recorded Friday morning before news broke that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died at age 87 of pancreatic cancer. Josh and the panel will cover what her legacy and her death mean for the High Court and American political life on next week's show. Thanks for listening.
This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the third week of September, and this week, President Trump got crosswise with his own CDC director, Robert Redfield, after Redfield told Congress that he didn't expect a coronavirus vaccine to be distributed widely enough that we can return to regular life until the second or third quarter of 2021. President Trump said Redfield must have been confused, that we'll have 100 million doses ready to go this fall. It's not going to have to wait for next summer. On MSNBC, Dr. Anthony Fauci offered a clarifying answer that I think squares this circle. If you ask when a vaccine will be available, it depends what you mean by available. The U.S. government is paying pharmaceutical companies to pre-produce doses of vaccines that might be approved. That means doses should be ready right after approval, and Fauci said that approval might happen in October, like the president hopes, though he thinks November or December is more likely. But it takes time to distribute and administer hundreds of millions of vaccine doses, even if you already have a lot of them manufactured when you start. So even if there is approval this fall, the point when the vaccine has been administered to the necessary fraction of the population would still not be until the middle part of next year. Redfield and Trump also disagreed about masks, with Redfield saying masks might be more important for preventing viral transmission than a vaccine, because a vaccine may be only partially effective. A vaccine that is partially effective and significantly reduces the risk of getting infected is a great population-level intervention to stop an epidemic from spreading, but it doesn't allow any individual to just decide they're immune. Trump disagreed with that too, and earlier in the week, he called into question whether masks really work very well at all, pointing out that a lot of people, including some waiters, don't like them. To talk about that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review on the right, and on the left, Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times. Hello.
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 Michael, the sort of talk that the president engaged in here, insisting that the vaccine is going to be the thing that works and it's going to come before the election and contradicting his own appointed director of the Centers for Disease Control, this is something that has a lot of Americans nervous, that he's going to rush an approval and a rollout of a vaccine in a way that puts politics ahead of public health. You wrote this week that people shouldn't worry too much about that.
Right. I mean, that Trump is interested in getting a vaccine out as soon as possible is obvious, but that doesn't distinguish him from any other leader in the world. There are not just concerns about, you know, reopening economies fully after a vaccine rolls out, hopefully, but there's realpolitik and there's vaccine diplomacy and other things that states can do if companies that are in their country or research universities are first to the finish line. So that is stipulated. And Trump can say things that make people nervous. He can tweet things that make people nervous. But what we've seen from the pharmaceutical companies themselves is a stunning amount, an unprecedented amount of transparency about their process, their studies. We've seen them make extraordinary commitments to not rush out a vaccine until phase three clinical studies are completed. Some of the closest to the finish line, like AstraZeneca, are running simultaneous studies in several countries, and they are dependent upon each other. That is, when they stop a study because of one adverse reaction in one patient, it stops worldwide, and there are independent boards in those countries. There are just so many layers of accountability for the vaccine producers and the scientists that when these vaccines come out, you will not have to put your personal faith in Trump's integrity to trust them. You will have to put your faith in the integrity of our medical establishment as it is. And I think a lot of people have trouble doing that. And polls show that I think 78% of Americans are worried that the process is too rushed as it is. I think that's a problem that's much deeper than President Trump.
Jamel, what do you make of that?
I think it's probably much deeper than President Trump, but it certainly doesn't help the situation that President Trump, who is so polarizing, who any issue President Trump touches becomes instantly polarized along the lines of how do you feel about President Trump. It doesn't help that he, instead of being, you know, in sync with public health officials about both the safety of a vaccine, but also the process, also the timeline, that he appears to be rushing things. And your typical person isn't plugged in to the information Michael just put out, just described, the process he just described. And I think that, you know, if President Trump just didn't take the states to talk about a vaccine, that if he deferred to public health officials about this and sort of deferred to their explanation, to their expertise, I don't think the numbers of people who are concerned about the speed of the speed with which the vaccine is being developed would be as high as they are. I do think that, you know, given, as I said before, very much what we know about President Trump's ability to polarize everything, that his, you know, his rhetoric on this, his the very clear sense you get from him that he wants this to happen as quickly as possible, is having a very significant adverse effect on people's willingness to receive a vaccine when they're available.
Michael, when I look at this, you wrote there is no Trump vaccine, and I think that's right. The president can't just like stick some mystery serum in a syringe and say, you know, make 500 million doses of this. This is great. Give it to everyone. He's not going to invent something out of thin air. So I don't worry about him directing the FDA to do something crazy. I do worry a little bit about the way the president has clearly put his thumb on the scale in some of the decisions that have been made at the FDA and at the CDC. And we saw this with hydroxychloroquine back in the spring. The president didn't come up with the idea that hydroxychloroquine, this existing malarial drug, could be used to treat coronavirus. This is something that the medical establishment was looking into. It had its advocates and its detractors within that establishment. But it does look to me like the FDA issued an emergency use authorization for that drug that it might not have issued if the president wasn't putting so much political pressure on them, and especially that it kept that authorization in place longer than it probably would have as the data started coming in and was disappointing about the extent to which that worked. And so I don't think the president can push the FDA into a crazy decision. I worry that he can push it into a bad decision when it's making a relatively close call. And there are going to be cost-benefit decisions with all of this. There are big public health benefits to getting the vaccine out as soon as possible, so long as it is safe. And so there's going to be this question about balancing speed versus certainty here. And it doesn't make me feel great the extent to which the president is clearly pushing on speed at the expense of certainty in a way that could influence that decision, even though he can't just make the decision up.
I understand that, and I agree with Jamel that there is a kind of, and Democrats talk about the trust issue in a way that's almost like Trump is a radioactive element in the public sphere and just reduces trust in all things merely by being so omnipresent and putting out so many contradictory messages himself, not only contradicting qualified members of the executive branch who are working on the problem, but even contradicting himself. So I stipulate all that. The trade-off between speed and certainty is there for everyone, every nation that's involved in this, and all of the drug makers. And of course, like I said, many of the drug makers are multinational corporations doing this on a multinational level. So we do have an ability to compare where we are compared to other nations in this. And like I said, the amount of scrutiny that is now, that the drug companies are now under, where they're publishing their blueprints for how they would how their studies are going to go through phase three, is unprecedented and public in a way that they aren't before, precisely because the federal government is subsidizing the quest for this vaccine to such an unprecedented degree. I think one thing that hasn't been mentioned, however, is that one reason that we see over a period of months this precipitous drop in public interest in receiving a vaccine for COVID-19 is also a precipitous increase in the ability of doctors to treat COVID-19 effectively, declining mortality rates, and just declining fear. I think the public itself is also making a kind of cost-benefit analysis of, they see that this obviously is being developed at a very rapid pace, partially because we're in a pandemic. That's what speeds up the process of testing 44,000 people or 30,000 people for a phase three trial. But people are making their own decision of how much they fear a disease versus how much they fear a vaccine that was developed in less than a year.
Yeah, I don't really know what to make of that polling. I mean, in general, I don't know what to make of polling that asks people theoretical questions about things that they might do that they cannot actually do right now. And partly, especially, so much polling about almost any issue that can be politicized in any way sort of becomes a way to express an opinion about Donald Trump. And if you don't like Trump, you take whatever the opposite position is. So I'm hopeful that some of that decline in people saying they'll take the vaccine is liberals who don't trust Trump on this, for whom it is sort of telling a pollster, oh, I'm nervous about the vaccine, is sort of an inexpensive way of expressing your distrust of Donald Trump, and that the question will be different for a lot of people when the vaccine is an actually existing thing that can provide direct benefits to them. But I do worry, precisely because of what you're describing there, Michael, the benefit of the vaccine, obviously there's a significant benefit to the individual in protection against COVID, but there's also this huge societal benefit that if everybody becomes a lot less likely to get COVID, that allows you to stop the epidemics. If you can't get it, you can't spread it to other people. So we really do need, when this vaccine is available, and when we have confidence, which I think we will, that our public health authorities have made good decisions in making it available, we'd really want people to be willing to take it. And so, Jamel, I'm wondering about the tightrope that Democrats are walking here, because they're expressing these concerns about Trump's handling the vaccine, I think because he gave them good reason to, because it is a good political message to point out that the president is playing politics with this. But Democrats also have been very focused over the last few years on standing against vaccine conspiracy theories and claims that vaccines cause autism, which is debunked in science. And so Democrats want people to be willing to take positive public health interventions. They will want people in the long run, they will want people when this vaccine is available to be taking it. So how do you message that? Because one of my big worries is that if the president loses this election, he's going to turn on a dime on the vaccine issue. He's going to go back to talking about it the way he's talked about other vaccines and start telling people it's not safe. So how do Democrats prepare to say on, you know, November 10th that people should get this vaccine?
That's a good question. My, you know, right now the messaging, I think Biden said this earlier this week, right, that we trust the public health officials, we trust the scientists, we don't necessarily trust Donald Trump. If Trump is defeated, then I don't think they'll have to do much. You know, they won't have to change the message very much at all. You know, Trump is not there. Yes, this happened under his decision making, but again, we trust the public health officials. We trust the scientists. You should get the vaccine. And sort of one of the, you know, the aspects of Democratic messaging this year has been this attempt to model, you know, good pandemic behavior. And I would expect that to continue. If Trump wins re-election, that'll be interesting to see how Democrats react. My hunch is that it will still be urging people to take the vaccine. For the simple reason that I think, you know, Democratic elected officials, like most Republican elected officials, sincerely want the pandemic to end. And I think Democrats would message accordingly, but I'm not actually sure. I wanted to comment on one aspect of this conversation that we kind of blew past a little, which was the note, right, that the vaccine, while will be good in the aggregate, will help you know, the herd, so to speak. Individual people may still need to wear a mask. And I think that's gonna be the tricky messaging, because when, you know, if and when there's a vaccine, I think we can fairly say that President Trump will use this to kind of lean even further into anti-mask views. We'll say you no longer need to wear a mask because we have the vaccine, and that's just not going to be true. And so I think there will be this, for Democrats, having to, you know, explain to the public, explain to voters, that no, a vaccine still means there should be mask usage as much as possible. And that'll be, I'm not sure how that will be received.
And so your idea is that's a message that will be necessary indefinitely, or it's a message that will be necessary over the period of months during which we're trying to get to a suitable population level of people having the vaccine?
The latter, right? There's because it's going to take time to disseminate a vaccine throughout the entire population, and because the vaccine is not necessarily going to be effective in every single individual person, it's still going to be necessary for people to wear masks until we can basically confirm that we've, you know, reduced the incidence of COVID to the point where you don't need to wear a mask.
Michael, do you think people are ready for essentially another year of these social interventions until we get to a point where there's hopefully widespread distribution of a vaccine?
I think there's going to be increased impatience with them. Some of it will be... a lot is going to depend on what Washington does to offer relief. I think the number of small business closures are getting actually frightening at this point. I think the pressure on public schools and on parents is basically intolerable at the current level for very long. And you're going to see what you've seen in throughout Europe and other places, which is growing anti-lockdown, anti-masking political movements. I do think you will see that. So I think a lot is dependent upon this vaccine. And I think people do have to promote trust and transparency from the pharmaceutical companies and in the pharmaceutical companies precisely because we want to get out of this dilemma, and they have to know that the trials aren't going to be rerun after the election, right? I mean, the scientific process is happening presently under Trump, and the results of that, whether they come before the election or after the election or during a Biden presidency, they're going to be the results we're relying on. So we have to be very careful about what we say we don't trust, that we don't a kind of conspiracy theory that we'll reap the rewards of later.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Michael Brendan Doherty of National Review and Jamel Bowie of the New York Times to talk about 1 billion Americans. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our Left, Right, and Center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. When we talk about politics, we spend a lot of time talking about how to make America better. But my next guest says that to be better, we have to be bigger. Matt Iglesias has a new book called 1 Billion Americans. He argues that America's role as a global economic hegemon has been a positive one, but that our economy can't stay bigger than China's forever if we only have about a fourth the population. He says America is an engine for prosperity that creates good lives for the people within it, and therefore we should try to have more people. We should admit more immigrants. We should make it easier for Americans to have more children if they want to. And we should build the housing and educational and transportation infrastructure to support them. If America had 1 billion residents, our population density would be about the same as France and only half that of Germany. So we know it is physically possible to fit that many people in this much space. But still, do we need to stay number one? And is this the right way to get there? Matthew Iglesias joins us now. Matt is co-founder of Vox, where he's a senior correspondent and co-host of The Weeds. The book is 1 Billion Americans, The Case for Thinking Bigger. Hello, Matt.
Hi, it's really good to be here.
So why should there be 1 billion Americans?
Look, we are at a time of sort of growing international competition. There's rising powers in Asia, especially China. And one of the big ideas of this book is that we should take that challenge really, really seriously and understand why is it that a country that's about as rich as Mexico or Bulgaria can sort of cut such a big swath on the international stage. And it's obvious. It's because there's a lot of people living in China. So can we get more people in the United States? And, you know, it turns out we absolutely can. And if you think about why has the United States historically been such a major power in the world, right? Why aren't we Canada? right? And it's clear. There's 10 times as many people in the United States as there are in Canada. That's something we've done fairly deliberately over the course of American history, right? America's leaders have traditionally wanted to be a major power, whether that's in a shining city on the hill example to the world sense, or, you know, participating in world wars, leading the free world in the Cold War. It's been an aspiration of America for most of our history to sort of be a great power. And I think it's a good aspiration and one we should continue to live up to.
How do you get the population to grow? I assume you don't intend to just tell people to have more children. A lot of people don't want to do that. What would it entail to make a conscious choice for there to be more Americans?
Well, so right now, you know, women have fewer children than they say they want to have, fewer than men say they want to have as well. And the primary reason they cite is the financial burdens of this. And we know from international comparisons that doing more to financially support families, it doesn't create huge changes in fertility behavior, but it does create modest ones. You know, people are a little more eager to start having children sooner, to go for a second or third child, things like that, if they have a little more money to do it. And right now, it's not an activity that's really financially supported by the structure of the American welfare state. We do, of course, have K-12 schools, or at least we did until the pandemic, but we don't do enough in terms of pre-K. We don't do enough in terms of just cash grants to parents and children. We don't do enough in terms of parental leave. And if we do those things, I think there's reason to believe the birth rate will rise and that'll help close the gap. Then, of course, the other way to get people is to let more immigrants come.
I want to bring in the panel to discuss Matt's big idea. On the right is Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review. On the left is Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times. And Elizabeth Nolan Brown also joins us for this conversation. Liz is senior editor at Reason, the Libertarian magazine. Hi, Liz.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So I want to start with Michael. I know, Michael, you had some thoughts about the immigration portion of Matt's prescription here.
Yeah, Matt, how much immigration would you envision or what rate? And I'd like to hear you talk about the political sustainability of that. I mean, I've seen some libertarianish proposals for a billion Americans before that say, well, when we have a billion Americans, mostly by immigration, we're going to have a lot more class stratification. And my worry would be that an America that's not a middle-class society won't have the will to be a great power in the world. So what would you say to that?
You know, my main thinking on immigration is that I want to give as much ground as possible to the sort of conservative nationalist take on this while upholding the view that immigration is basically beneficial to the United States. I think there's a ton of empirical research on that. That being said, look, it is true that there are particularly political problems with having large numbers of unskilled, uneducated immigrants who don't speak English coming into the country. I think the proposal to revisit the kind of family unification paradigm and emphasize instead your ability to contribute to the fiscal base, your ability to speak English, your ability probably to have technical skills, that's a perfectly reasonable idea to me. At the same time, if you can get better at selecting immigrants, that should make you open to more immigrants rather than fewer. The shape of the Trump proposal on this is essentially to say, look, I want to cut immigration in half, and then I want to minimize the economic harm that does by improving the skill selection. We should think about that the other way, right? We should improve our selectivity, and then having done that, we should be more open to more people. I don't pick a precise target number because it really is a politically constrained thing. I want people who appreciate the value of immigration to be more flexible about the politics of it and sort of do what we can to make immigration acceptable to people who have doubts while saying we should be pushing for more.
Liz, what do you make of that? Because usually when libertarians talk about supporting more immigration, they have a more constrained view of what a welfare state should be. And so the idea is, you know, you can come here and you can work as you like, but the government's not going to spend a lot of money. Matt's vision, as we'll talk about in a moment, involves a significant expansion of the benefits the government will pay for people. So does that come into conflict at all with the idea of a much more open immigration policy?
I don't think that while we do differ with, you know, what we think perhaps should happen once people are here, I don't think that any libertarian would say that that's a reason to keep people out. You know, it's a fundamental, you know, the right to migrate and things like that are a fundamental human right. And I don't think what happens, you know, our policies after people are here should matter, or, you know, how they're going to vote once they're here, which is another thing you hear, like, oh, they're all going to be liberal or they're all going to be conservative. I don't think, you know, the after effects are the thing we should be worried about when we're designing our immigration policies.
Jamel, what do you think about this proposal? Where, because it feels to me like Matt has picked a piece from what Republicans say and a piece from what Democrats say. The Republicans talk about shifting toward a more skills-based immigration system, but as you've seen with some of the legislation from Trump's allies in Congress, they sort of smuggle in this significant reduction in overall immigration levels with that shift. While Democrats, I think, are often really uncomfortable with talking about the idea that some immigrants would be better than others and that we would want the U.S. to make specific decisions about who should come here, even though, of course, our current policy already does make those decisions, including allocating significant weight to the skills and education that potential immigrants to the U.S. have. Is this synthesis that Matt has, is this the right one, where you say more immigrants but with a different thought about which kinds of immigrants?
If we mean right in terms of just what might be politically feasible, I think Matt is onto the right idea. If you look at public opinion is generally supportive of greater immigration and especially supportive of greater skilled immigration. I think the interesting wrinkle here, this is just kind of an observation, is that if the kind of mix Matt describes, right, higher skilled, English speaking, I don't know how you design for this policy wise, but sort of like, you know, people who are used to or comfortable with or have some experience with the kind of democratic institutions the United States has, if you're selecting for those immigrants, you're selecting for immigrants really from a lot of former British Commonwealth states. And you're selecting for immigrants from Nigeria, you're selecting for immigrants from India, you're selecting for immigrants from other countries in Africa. And there's this interesting wrinkle to think about, right? If you have greater skilled, educated, English-speaking immigration from non-white states, how does that play out politically? Because it's just sort of, it is simply the case that some portion of anti-immigrant energy is pretty much because the bulk of recent immigrants are not white.
There's two layers to the political issues there. One is what Jamel is talking about, you know, the way that non-white immigration plays into opposition to immigration. You also have that would presumably be a less Latino group of immigrants that would be admitted to the United States. So what does this mean for immigration politics?
Yeah, I mean, it would involve, you know, if Democrats want to take this cause on, treating immigration as a policy issue that is about the national interest rather than about the ethnic politics of the U.S. Latino community. I think that's fine. I mean, I think that's the right thing to do on the merits. I also think politically there's a growing appreciation that immigration is not actually a top concern for Hispanic voters in the United States. So, like, it shouldn't structure Democrats thinking about it so much. Then on the other hand, for the right, you know, I mean, this is exactly what Jamel said, right? This is an effort to take seriously the serious points that conservatives make about immigration. At the same time, I mean, my belief, and I think Jamel's belief, is that a lot of what drives opposition to immigration is simply racism. I don't think it's the only thing that's out there, but it is a hefty chunk of the concern. And I think we just see, right, there is a sharp tension between really wanting America, like American nationalism and American greatness, and kind of white cultural grievance politics. And I think that's a theme we've seen sort of throughout American history. And the immigration issue, you know, puts a fine point on it, right? I think under a good system that's responsive to skills and language, you would have a lot of Asian immigrants, you would have a lot of Black immigrants, you would have some European immigrants, but it would continue to be a flow primarily of non-white people, simply because that's where the desire to migrate comes from.
Let's talk about families and this idea that supporting more families will get you a higher birth rate. Liz, I know you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I want to start by saying I think the book has a lot of interesting ideas on this, and I'm really glad to see someone addressing the birth rate issue from the left for a change. It's primarily from the right. And also, I don't think that there's any stock in the idea that trying to help people have more kids is anti-feminist. But I'm not convinced that truly pro-natalist policies are practically possible. No developed country, even those with huge social support systems in place, has used them to sustain fertility above the replacement rate. And I'm also skeptical about the idea that people are having fewer kids than they want. Matt looks at this one figure, and this is one that Lyman Stone brings up a lot too, about women have told surveyors they want 2.7 children on average, and yet they have 1.8 or 1.7 children on average now. And he draws two conclusions from this, that A, women are having less kids than they would like to, and B, that increasing economic support for families will help ameliorate that. I think we hit issues even before addressing that a second assumption, because a lot of people say maybe that they want 2 or 3 or 4 kids when they're younger. And then when it comes down to it, they decide for reasons totally unrelated to economics that they actually only want 1 or 2 or 3 because their family feels complete without that extra child they thought they wanted, or they're having a lot more fulfillment in their career and realize they actually want a smaller family, or they had a really tough pregnancy and they realize, you know, for health reasons they can't go through it again, or their partner doesn't want as many, or as Matt does mention, you know, a lot of people are struggling with fertility. I think that that's a lot bigger component of it than he sort of allows for. So, you know, a lot of these are, some of these aren't even problems. Some are problems that no amount of corporate or government policy can change. And some could be addressed by making it easier for people to adopt and things like that. So I guess my question for Matt is how are you so sure that economics is really the defining issue here, especially considering that it's wealthier and more educated Americans who are having fewer kids?
Well, you know, I mean, look, we have research on pronatalist policies that have been tried around the world. I think most of the empirical research on it has shown that these programs have tended to disappoint the hopes of the proponents. It's typically been done by, you know, right of center or sometimes even far right governments who are really focused on natalism and sort of like don't like the welfare state in the abstract. But they were like, all right, this is going to be great. We're going to have a huge baby boom. And it doesn't really work. At the same time, you do see an increase, right? I mean, the statistics look at it and they show that when you give people particularly money up front, which sort of baby bonus policies do, it does have an impact on fertility decisions. Of course, it would be strange, right, if people's decisions in this regard were completely unaffected by the sort of economic environment. Now, I'm not a conservative. I'm not, you know, on the far right. I think that reducing child poverty would like be a good idea anyway. I think it happens to be the case that this policy would, in fact, you know, improve people's ability to have larger families. And I think it's telling that, you know, in the surveys, it's true. Some people do say, well, I decided to have fewer children because I wanted to spend more time with the kids I already have, or I decided to have fewer children because, you know, my career was more important. But a predominant answer does speak to the economics. People cite the cost of childcare, they cite the overall cost of family life, or they say that, well, in retrospect, they started too late in life. Because, you know, the economy has evolved to a point where people get more schooling, where childcare is more expensive. It takes longer to achieve the kind of financial stability that people want. And, you know, human biology doesn't just sort of change to meet the whims of how the market economy has evolved. So I think there's just a fundamentally strong case for leaning a little bit against the Baumol law effects. I also do take in, you know, a few libertarian ideas about how to reduce the cost of childcare. There's some good evidence that we have overregulated this sector. I'm not like a totally dogmatic, just spend more money on it thing, but I do think it's worth spending more money.
Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing that troubles me about the natalist policies we see in Hungary or in Poland is not the moral thing. It's just the results aren't, you know, in a sense, they're not good enough. And in the United States, the problem isn't just, you know, the problem of, you know, what the demographers call realized fertility. It's also a crashing marriage rate that's, I'm sure, behind at least some of the decrease in overall fertility that we're seeing right now and may be responsible for more of it in the future. Again, as the conservative here, my concern is maintaining a great power status in the world if the social fabric of the country is more atomized, which I think is where we're headed unless there's kind of dramatic reversal of these trends in marriage and fertility. It's those trends that I think bond people to their neighborhoods, their extended family, and through their extended family to more opportunity in life. And, you know, if anything, I would privilege it more than Matt does as a going concern forward.
Is that amenable to policy, though? Like, I mean, if giving people money does it, can the government do anything to encourage people to get married?
I mean, the craziest fertility bump we've seen recently, I think, was in the country of Georgia. And it was tied to religion and, you know, the primate archbishop of the country promised to baptize every child that was born because they were in such a fertility spiral. And they did see a huge increase in the following few years. So it may take something like religious revival to do that. But I think... if it's necessary for the survival of the country, I mean, this will happen one way or another at some point.
You know, I mean, I do think that we should think about marriage. I mentioned a little bit in the book, you know, an argument that some conservatives make that the welfare state design creates significant marriage penalties for people in the bottom third of the income distribution. I think that that's true, and I think that we should try to address that. It's not totally clear to me how much of a difference that would make. I think it's been a little bit of an understudied subject. You know, when George W. Bush was president, he talked about marriage a lot, but he didn't really do a lot on the policy side. So we didn't get a lot of evaluation of marriage initiatives. I mean, I think sending somebody around like twice a year to people on welfare to like yell at them and say it would be better to get married, like that pretty clearly doesn't work. There's probably something you could do there, but we don't know that much about what it is. Academics, you know, because they're culturally liberal, don't seem that interested in this topic. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to find a ton of like really good research, either debunking marriage promotion programs or showing which ones are effective. But it's worth at least trying to look at, because we do know that marriage is an important factor in, you know, I mean, in childbirth decisions, but also just in people's overall happiness.
Jamel, this is kind of a funny issue for liberals, because I think liberals are generally really uncomfortable with the idea that you should try to influence people's family decisions toward having more children. But a lot of the individual policies that Matt recommends, because he thinks that they would encourage people to have more children, are policies that liberals are very much in favor of, universal pre-K and child allowances and that sort of thing. Should liberals be more willing to say, like, in addition to alleviating child poverty, this stuff might encourage people to have more kids and that would be good?
I think so. I mean, that's sort of where I come to it on these questions, that, you know, I think you can make a good case, as Matt does, that people want to have more kids. People want to have larger families than they do. And even those that don't still want to be able to feel comfortable raising a child, who don't want to feel stressed and burdened by all the, you know, financial and childcare duties that come with having a child. And so I think liberals, the left, should speak much more about this. One of the, back in the 2016 Democratic primary, one of the best ads of that entire cycle was from Bernie Sanders. And it was a very striking ad where the senator sold Medicare for All specifically, I think, on the basis that, you know, the goal of American society should be able to provide, you know, decent wages and decent work for people. And then when you retire, to be able to spend time with your family, that's what we're doing this for, doing all of this for. And I happen to think that's a compelling message. I think all of this, the conversation about natalism also segues into a conversation about housing, which I think we're going to have, which is that part of the puzzle here is that in addition to, you know, it being expensive to have a kid, it's just expensive to live in the United States, or it's expensive to live in many of the places where economic growth is happening, where many people are living.
That actually provides a good transition, because if we take Matt up on his offer and we try to aim for a billion Americans, that means finding a place to house and finding a way to provide services to an additional 650 million or so Americans. So how would we do that? How would we meet those challenges? We're going to take a break and come back and talk about that with Jamel Bowie of the New York Times, Michael Brendan Doherty of National Review, Elizabeth Nolan Brown of Reason, and Matt Iglesias of Vox. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back in with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review. On the left is Jamelle Bouie, columnist at the New York Times. And our special guests are Elizabeth Nolan Brown, senior editor at Reason, and Matt Iglesias of Vox, author of the new book, 1 Billion Americans. We've been talking about Matt's thesis that America needs to be bigger to be better. And I want to talk a little bit about what we would do with so many people. I'm sort of imagining if you had a billion Americans, this like National Board of Zoning Appeals meeting where we had consider a plan to construct 200 million new housing units to house all those Americans. I'm imagining the public comment period. It's a real mess, all the community objections that would be raised. And so, Jamelle, what do you make of this? I know that, you know, that housing is already a big issue, housing affordability in a lot of the coastal metro areas in the U.S. What do you make of this project if we were going to have so much more housing for so many more people?
Right, Matt. My question is, obviously, this would require a big change to how housing policy happens on the coast. But there's also this big, vast interior of the country, many parts of it that have kind of the infrastructure or had the infrastructure for much larger populations than are currently there. One of my favorite little tidbits, right, that St. Louis used to have about 800,000 people, and now it's less than half of that. And that kind of story is similar throughout the Midwest and throughout the country. So I'm just sort of curious what your broader vision beyond the construction of housing on the coast, upzoning, you know, the YIMBY policy basket. Beyond that, what is your vision for constructing housing for people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be good. I mean, it would be good in part for independent reasons, but particularly critical if we were to try to grow the population, to see what we can do to sort of decentralize growth to some extent. I was a proponent, you know, early on of the idea that we should try to move some federal agencies out of the DC area, maybe to underbuilt, more affordable Midwestern cities where there might be complementarities. The Trump administration, I write in the book about their effort to do this with some part of the USDA. It hasn't gone very well, but, you know, I still think it's a good idea. It needs to be pursued in a thoughtful way, though, which is one of the reasons why I think sort of national growth and national greatness helps to become a useful frame for overcoming a lot of problems that people know are real. But I would be very interested in trying to get the government to be a little bit more involved with things like the big HQ2 sweepstakes, right?
This was Amazon's search for a second corporate headquarters.
Yeah. So they kind of dangled this prospect of a huge influx of office jobs before a lot of cities. They got a million places to sort of pony up there. Here's the subsidy scheme I'll offer you. But then in the end, they chose like New York and the DC suburbs. And then in New York, there was a kind of local NIMBY freakout, and people were like, we don't even want you here. And to an extent, I mean, who can even blame New Yorkers for not wanting even more office jobs? They have a lot, or at least they did. You know, and the federal government could try to both tamp down the competitive subsidy bidding, but also to shape and nudge these kind of relocation decisions to go to places where there's a national interest in seeing more sort of job growth, more white-collar jobs. And that would be places like St. Louis or Detroit or Cleveland, places that have, you know, big airports and lots of cultural institutions. And there's lots of good stuff in those declining Midwestern cities. The big problem is that there isn't economic opportunity there for high-wage, high-skilled professionals. And then because of that, there's declining population, which means there just aren't great job opportunities to like be a plumber in a city where the population is shrinking, as opposed to a place that's booming. And it's great that we have booming populations in Nashville and Atlanta and San Antonio and Austin, those Sunbelt cities. But if we have very little national growth, then that becomes zero sum, right? And the prosperity that they've achieved in a lot of the Sunbelt really comes at the expense of the Midwest and the sort of fringier parts of the Northeast. If we had more growth overall, we would need to try to sort of spread the wealth, so to speak, but also we would have the opportunity to spread the wealth. Like, I don't think people want endless decline of the, you know, smaller cities of Ohio, but we should do something about it.
I don't know, though. I mean, I see, we know where immigrants tend to go because we already have substantial immigration flows and they go disproportionately to cities on the coast. And I think we would expect that to continue to be true. People are not, by and large, immigrating to the U.S. in order to move to Cleveland, although some of them do that. But I think that we would have to prepare both to sort of revitalize those Midwestern cities, but we would have to expect, if we were going to have a population population of a billion, that cities like New York and Los Angeles would be drastically bigger than they are today. And so we would need to find a way to accommodate that. I mean, you can look, I know you talk in the book about Tokyo. This is an example of a great world city that has continued to grow and grow and grow in housing units and is building enough housing units to accommodate that population. Even though Japan is not growing, Tokyo continues to grow as people move from the rest of Japan into Tokyo. Is there a way that we can bring that model in to places like New York and Los Angeles? And how would people there feel about that? Because I think, you know, when people object to more homes near them, it's not just about, like, I don't want anything to change or I'm skeptical of these new people. It's also people are genuinely concerned that, you know, there's going to be more traffic and it's going to be harder to park and the schools are full and maybe the property taxes on the new housing units that you build, they're not going to cover the cost of expanding the services in the school district. How do you change that equation so people are willing to have more of the housing units where they are going to be demanded?
Yeah, I mean, this is really a question of the level at which political decisions get made. It's completely rational to feel that if there's more house building right where you live, that that imposes a lot of hassle costs on you in terms of traffic, just like noise. There was apartment construction that was going on for over a year across the street from me, and it was just like all kinds of problems. Cranes were there, the street was blocked, it stirred up all kinds of rats. At the same time, broad growth in the housing stock would be very beneficial. You know, it would grow the tax base, it would create more job opportunities, better matches. The book, you know, we go through the whole litany. The problem is that those benefits are diffuse and the costs are very, very concentrated. In America, we give sort of neighbor veto to projects. And neighbors exercise that veto, and they do it for good reason. But if we make the decision at a higher level, people would have a different rational calculus. If saying yes meant yes to regional population growth throughout the Bay Area, that would have a lot of benefits. And the big difference between the U.S. and Japan in terms of urban growth is not that, you know, Japanese people don't care about traffic jams. It's that land use decisions are made by the central government rather than by sort of hyper-local neighborhood groups. In the U.S., you know, fortunately, we have state government, which exists as an intermediate level, and that's the place where it would make sense to say yes to change. We've seen in California over the past few years a succession of important housing reforms that have passed the state legislature and a couple of even bolder ones that came close and then just fell short. But so the model for change would be to sort of get those initiatives a little bit over the top, because a lot of the time what you see is that in survey data, you know, people are fairly open to the idea of broad increases in the housing stock. But in terms of who shows up to a community meeting to talk about a particular project, that's where you get the people who have concerns. Some of them are nutty concerns, but some of them are perfectly reasonable. It's just that you're not going to have success by allowing that kind of local veto of everything. We need to elevate the discussion.
Liz, what do you make of that?
I mean, I think that's all very interesting. I really am more about the other aspect of that, which is how do you make the policies that get people to these smaller cities, in addition to, you know, how are we going to transform these bigger cities too? I was thinking still about, you know, how do you design immigration policies? There has to be ways to get people to go to these failing cities in the Midwest, which I'm actually calling, talking to you right now from Cincinnati, Ohio, which is not a failing city, but there's a fair share around here. So I'm curious what Matt's ideas are for getting immigrants that come here to come to these places that are undervalued as opposed to the coastal cities.
Yeah, so one idea that the U.S. Conference of Mayors has embraced is to say that cities that want to sponsor extra visas should sort of get the right to say, okay, there's going to be some, I don't know what you call them, like a Detroit visa, and somebody can come here, they live for 5 years, if they sort of follow the terms, then they can convert to a regular green card. I think that's a good idea. I think presumably a lot of people would leave after their five-year stint. Not everybody would, because we know, like, once people go somewhere, some of them put down roots there. Another impact is that I think if we had broad national population growth, naturally more people would be attracted to some smaller cities because the cities that are already big would be getting even bigger, right? So if you wanted aspects of, you know, the current lifestyle, you might find greater success finding that there in the Midwest. And then the last thing is, you know, trying to sort of move these levers. I mean, this is my least libertarian take in the book, but I do think the government should try to nudge corporate America to make location decisions that take into some account the national interest and not just the sort of rational, endless clustering in San Francisco, Seattle, and New York, because I don't know, that's like what we have national politics for, is to advance against the national interest.
Yeah, I guess my question was not just about development in cities, but the tension between growing our cities and growing the native population in them, right? I mean, I think Seattle has more dog parks than parks for children at this point. And that seems to be kind of the tension, is that there are not only nations or regions of the world that act as population shredders, but the cities themselves kind of act as them, because the city lifestyle imposes exactly those costs and trade-offs on individuals that make them, that incline them to choose to have fewer children. So, you know, you can get away for a while with this population momentum effect that Tokyo is enjoying now, where the city grows even as the nation is starting to go into terminal decline. But then the growth of that city, in a sense, fuels the further decline of the population as it drives down fertility rates. So, I mean, how do you make New York City or Los Angeles, especially if they're growing, more hospitable for children?
Well, what I think is the other way around, right? That if you make the national culture more hospitable to having children, that in part encourages people to live in outside of these central cities. What I say in the book, I reference exactly this dog thing. I say, you know, the rise of central cities where dogs outnumber children reflects some policy failures, but also urban areas function as kind of playgrounds for the childless, right? Like it's fine, kind of childless 20-somethings going to brunch, getting drunk in big cities. But rural areas, really, like the comparative advantage there is raising families, raising children in tight-knit communities. And if you have a culture, a society, like in Japan, where there are very few children at all, that gives people a good reason to sort of endlessly cluster in the biggest cities. I think that if you had sort of better housing policy that would make central cities more family friendly, just because you could get bigger houses. But more to the point, I think if you had a more family friendly broad culture and policy framework, both in terms of cash support, regulatory support, some kind of cultural cheerleading, I don't know what, you would have more people opting to live in lower density areas and less of the kind of impulse to cluster. Because, I mean, it's obviously a classic thing, right? People move to the city when they're young, they get married, they have kids, they move out, right? If people got married a little bit younger, if they had kids a little bit earlier, if they placed a little more priority on that, then, you know, more people, I think, would be opting for non-central city things. I grew up in Manhattan. I'm raising a kid in Logan Circle in DC. I like kids in the city, but I mean, that's obviously not the predominant preference.
What would be the climate impact of a shift like this? I mean, obviously more Americans would mean more carbon emissions from America. You're also talking about putting people in larger homes, putting more people outside central cities. Those are lifestyles where people will tend to have, you know, more emissions intensive lifestyles. Should we worry that there will be significant negative climate impacts from trying to grow the population so much? Or are there specific things that we should do to try to mitigate that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have a sort of boring, moderate view on climate change that sometimes gets hard to explain in a radio interview, but I think that we should worry more about climate change than US conservatives worry about it, right? Because they don't worry about it at all. And we should do the things that people who worry about climate change say we should do, right? We should have fees to discourage carbon dioxide emissions. We should have investments in deploying solar panels and batteries in electric cars. We should have investments in research and development to look at next generation nuclear, to look at solutions for cement and steel. There's these really serious climate problems that we ought to be doing something about. And right now we're doing almost nothing. At the same time, I don't think we should worry so much as the left-wing people who say the world's going to become uninhabitable or nobody should have kids because it's bad for climate change. It's a very serious problem, but it's not an extinction-level occurrence that should allow us to trump human flourishing, right? We should be doing things that are compatible with human flourishing, which is more than we're currently doing, but we shouldn't give up on life. And so climate exists in a strange place in the discourse, right? Where you write a book, you're a liberal writer, you come out with a book, you go on, you know, shows that air on NPR stations, and there's people who are, I would say, too geared up about climate change, as in that I have to say, like, oh, calm down, calm down. At the same time, if you compare to actual federal policy. It's not that we should calm down about climate change. It's that we should actually take reasonable steps to address it. So that's where I land in the book, right? It does tend to increase emissions. It should be a concern. Climate change should be a concern, but it shouldn't be a trump card.
There's been a lot of talk about nationalism in American politics over the last few years. The president would certainly describe himself as a nationalist. Is this a nationalist book?
I think that it is. I mean, I used to go on like weird things about nationalism versus patriotism, and maybe it's a patriotic book more than it's a nationalist book, depending on how you sort of think about it there. I do think it's a book that takes America seriously, right, as an idea worth fighting for. You know, it's like we got red, white, and blue on the cover. You know, it's a case for national greatness. But I think that there's this brand of nationalism that is about xenophobia, right? That says, okay, that to love America means to like be mean to foreigners. I don't embrace that. I think immigrants are good. I think there's a lot to be said for international trade. I think alliances are good, right? I'm not a quote unquote nationalist like that. At the same time, I'm not somebody who says like, well, America has like done bad things in the past, so we just like shouldn't care about it at all. America has done a lot of good things. America, you know, for all of its problems, is a place that a lot of people from around the world want to come to. They have good reason for that. I think that we should build an inclusive vision of America. I think that we've always been at our strongest when we aim for more inclusion. We aim for the sort of high civic ideals of the founding rather than the low realities that are out there. So I'll leave it up to you to tell me whether that's an authentically nationalist vision or not.
Jamil, what do you make of that frame?
You know, I live in Charlottesville, Virginia, and Monticello is right down the street from me. And so the thing that comes to mind for me is just like Jefferson's idea of an empire of liberty. It's a very classically American idea that the country's growth is a good because it expands kind of the, you know, the Republican experiment ever further, and that American leaders should do everything they can to facilitate that growth, which is how you get a president like Jefferson, you know, kind of engaged in a, you know, presidential power grab to expand the territory of the country by some insane amount. And I don't, you know, I'm not sure whether or not you would call Matt's argument nationalist, but it certainly does fall into this very well-defined tradition of Americanism.
Liz, is a nationalism of this sort, or whatever you want to call it, patriotism, is it merited from a libertarian perspective? Because, I mean, we started this by talking about China, and Matt saying that we need to compete with China. Does America need to, rather than just being part of a community of nations, do we need to assert some sort of global leadership role? Because otherwise China, which is so authoritarian, will do it?
I don't know about that necessarily, but I do kind of like the idea of reclaiming nationalism from the far right. Matt's vision of nationalism that he described is a very positive one, and I think it's very much one that libertarians could get behind. I think libertarians, sort of more than any other group, are very celebratory of our founding principles, and also have always been, at least at our best, have been, you know, very aware of the flaws too. And so a sort of nationalism that doesn't discount entirely and say, yes, America was, you know, founded on all these flawed principles, so therefore it's hopeless, that does sort of embrace our positive qualities, but is realistic about the negative too. I think, I mean, that would be an amazing thing. I don't know how much of a market there is for it, but I think it's a very inspiring or positive way to look at it.
Michael, what do you think? Is this nationalist? Because I never know how to think about that in American context. Because if you're a small country, nationalism can be about being distinct and apart. But America is so big, and our global leadership role, I think, is so central a part of our history, as is immigration, that you need a different vision of what nationalism would mean here than what it would mean in Ireland or Denmark or wherever. So is this, do you consider this a nationalist view?
Yeah, this is nationalism. In the sense that, I mean, my view is that nationalism is a kind of opportunistic force in politics, and it's usually driven in a spirit of arousal or envy or jealousy or fear. Any of those could be the case, whether it's war. In this case, I think Matt is looking at the world and seeing that America has challengers for global leadership, and he views America's leadership as more benign in the world, and its place in the world as a leader is important to its own internal cohesion and identity. And he's trying to protect that. I mean, that at least that's, Matt, you can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I would consider that a nationalist project. And in fact, most nationalisms are, you know, a project-based political movement. They nationalism rises when there's a kind of goal or, you know, achievement to be had in the world, and you're trying to rouse people to the call, whether it's Manifest Destiny, whether it's beating Hitler in the war, or whether it's something darker. That's that kind of rhetoric of arousing our passions to do something big. I think that's exactly what nationalism is about. And you can call it benign nationalism if you like, but that, I think, is what Matt is aiming for.
So Matt, you're a Democrat. How would you have Democrats put this vision into practice? I mean, obviously, I'm sure you would like people to buy and read your book, but if Joe Biden wins this election and he becomes president, what does this tell him he should focus on should he take office?
I think he should absolutely focus on getting more family support into a COVID relief package. It's something he just talked about yesterday, sort of doing American Families Act. That's the kind of low-hanging fruit for Democrats here. His housing bill, his stated housing policy, involves this kind of carrot and stick effort to get cities to change their zoning. I think there's some technical flaws in that proposal. It should be, he should call up the people at Mercatus Center who have some ideas to slightly improve it there. Immigration is just such a hard issue in Congress. I laid out a reasonable bargaining framework for Democrats to adopt there. But, you know, there's like a lot of reasons for Republicans to not want to deal over and above their kind of substantive objections to it. Mostly, though, like I am a fairly feisty partisan person in my real life, but this is not a feisty partisan book. I mean, I think I try to write about things that are of interest to conservatives, things that are of interest to Republicans. There's some ideas for things that they might want to take up, framings they might want to adopt. I think fundamentally, if we are going to refocus on growth and refocus on sort of America's standing in the world, it's going to take contributions from Democrats and from Republicans. I don't think this is going to be like a 7-point plan that any one president enacts all at once. It's more a kind of a shift in cultural thinking to, we want to be talking about how do we stay number one forever? How does these decisions we make impact fertility? How does it impact population growth? How does it impact housing capacity? And, you know, in an optimistic vision of the next 80 years of politics, it's that some of this stuff would be done on a bipartisan basis, some would be done by Republicans, some by Democrats, and onward until, you know, three more generations.
Let's leave it there. This has been a really interesting conversation. I want to thank Elizabeth Nolan Brown of Reason for joining us, and also Matt Iglesias of Vox. Again, his new book is called 1 Billion Americans. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Jamel Bowie, it's your soapbox.
The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, was warning against these proposals to eliminate the filibuster in the Senate. And he said that after Democrats change the filibuster, they're going to admit the District of Columbia as a state. They're going to admit Puerto Rico as a state. That's 4 new Democratic senators in perpetuity. Once they get a hammerlock on the Senate, they're going to then pack the Supreme Court. Now, I don't think Democrats are going to try to pack the Supreme Court. It's also the case that if you had 4 Democratic senators, immediately Republicans would still have the majority in the Senate. But I want to rant just a little bit about the implicit idea here, which is that if, you know, Puerto Ricans vote and decide that they want to be a state and they get statehood, if the District of Columbia becomes a state, that these voters there are somehow unreachable by Republicans. That might be a little more true in D.C., but it's not true of Puerto Rico, where Republican lawmakers or representatives have won elections there and quite consistently. It, to me, shows kind of a refusal to engage in basic Democratic politics. And even though I do not vote for Republicans, I am very troubled by the idea that Republican leaders would look at the prospect of giving more Americans voting representation and say, no, I don't want that because it means I would have to do the work of trying to persuade them to vote for me.
Michael Brennan Doherty, what's your rant?
2 years ago, Montenegro joined the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Donald Trump said a bunch of stupid things about it at the time, and he was criticized broadly by the foreign policy establishment. However, I would just like to say a pox on all their houses. Montenegro is never a good candidate for NATO membership, and it proved why last week when it had, or earlier this month, it had an election, and a far-right party, Democratic Front, came to power. This party is much more friendly toward Vladimir Putin personally and to Serbia's government than to NATO and the EU. This was eminently foreseeable, as Montenegro had been governed by a corrupt administration that was just pro-Western for three decades, and it was obvious this government was on the way out. And now people that care about NATO are freaking out, but if they only have themselves to blame. This was foreseeable, and it was foreseen. They had it coming.
For my rant, New York City has twice delayed the in-person reopening of its public schools. Mayor Bill de Blasio told WNYC Radio that the reopening of schools was, quote, a greater challenge than anyone foresaw, unquote. Certainly it was a huge challenge, but it was a foreseeable challenge. This is hard, but it's really important. Children are falling behind without in-person education. Lower-income families especially are struggling with uncertain childcare situations when they don't know when the city's going to announce that it's going to be at least a couple of more weeks before their kids are back in school. And especially in areas like the Northeast, where COVID incidence is relatively low, some schools are finding ways to operate at least partly in person. It's hard, but it's the government's job, it's the mayor's job, and they had 6 months to work on this foreseeable problem. Businesses that depend on reopening to stay afloat are innovating however they can to operate in whatever modified manner is possible. Sometimes it's not a great modified manner. I'm not under the illusion that schools can or should operate in a totally normal manner now. But this is the job of our elected officials. It's a really high-stakes question, and they need to do better of finding a good answer to it. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Jamel Bowie, Michael Brendan Doherty, Matt Iglesias, and Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.